Before we go back to Rabbi Halpern, I want to hear a little bit more about him. Wait a minute. Stay with Friedel for a moment. Is there anything more to be said? He was here a very long time, and most of his habits are well known to the public, his public, what he wanted to do, what he wouldn't do, and how, you know, the type
Well, don't forget that he was here before what they used to call the move to orthodoxy and
yes,
reform.
Right.
So he didn't have bar mitzvahs, he didn't have practically no Hebrew prayers so forth. Zionism was, I don't think he ever preached on Zionism in the temple. He did speak on Zionism to the community at large, but I don't think within his temple at all.
Okay. there's been a change. Do you have any feeling whether that represented anything deeply felt on his part, the thing?
Well, actually, the changes that came in the temple, I think, came under...
Under Jacob.
Under Jacob, under
his absolutely, but I'm asking you a very personal reaction.
I don't know.
Have you any basis for judging whether these were deeply felt positions of his or whether he was reflecting a constituency?
I think that it's a little bit of both. That if his consistency had been different, he might have been a little bit different. But he, well, don't forget, this was a period when the hardline reform movement was being formulated.
Not by mid-60s.
Look, no, not by mid-60s. But once you're in a certain mold, it's difficult to break out of it.
Well,
for example, to give you an example. He was more strictly reformed than his good friend Abba Hillel Silver.
That's right.
Yeah.
By far, the only match I know of him is the Hollywood Temple rabbi, whatever his, I can't remember his name. His only counterpart. The last two places in reformed that didn't have bar mitzvah was Friedhof
and Sussman.
Sussman at Hollywood Temple.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, he was a good friend of mine, Sussman, but. He was a president, the national president of the COA. Now that's another thing. For example, Friedhof did not go out into the national scene like
that's
Abba
right.
Hillel,
that's right,
and like the others. Like Stephen Wise, for example.
He was a good enough speaker.
Yeah, yeah. But well, he had a different approach from both of them. I mean, he couldn't move you the way Wise or a Silver could.
No, he spoke in a literary.
That's right. Yeah, and not as strong of voice as the others and so forth. So he did not outside of the reform movement itself. And I don't know whether he was ever president of the Reform Rabbis.
I don't think so. No.
In other words, he more or less devoted himself to his congregational
congregation movement. and his response. He wrote 10 books of that stuff.
Yeah.
And I was trying to discern whether you had, you know, what in him you could sense all that represented.
I'll tell you, his turning to responsive maybe was a harking back to his childhood, you know. The values of his childhood. In other words, even though he didn't, as far as theology, accept it, he accepted it as being part of Judaism, something that's essential to Judaism. I think that's where...
The Borowitz, Rabbi Gene Borowitz, was who I was quoting for, who said that without halakha, there is no Judaism.
Which is true, but I don't know what the Reformed Jews would be.
Well, no, he's the Reformed theologian, Borowitz. Now, the question is, how do you compose these two things?
Well, it's difficult. It's something that I suppose a Reformed rabbi
has to cope with.
No, but I can't answer. For me, it's difficult to see the difference between them. I mean, because I base my Judaism on halakha, so it's no problem for me.
Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, so little of halakha is applicable in the modern world. So
I find that it's all applicable.
Wait a minute. Huge sections of...
sacrifices?
Not even sacrifices. All the money related
a jurisprudence. All right. Well, jurisprudence, first of all, if somebody comes with a court case, you follow the Chosam of Mishpat, which is jurisprudence. But it's true. But I mean that people very seldom come with a court case to the rabbis.
That's
although previously it was more prevalent. In other words, in Rabbi Ashinsky's time, no doubt they had a lot of what
because their relations were primarily between Jews in the community.
Yeah. But now they usually, even when it's between Jews, they go to the secular courts.
Of course.
It's true that that is not applicable. But I'm talking about things that are applicable. For example, kashrus, dietary laws, synagogue and holiday procedures, things that are...
Get.
Domestic laws, between men and women and so forth.
Yeah. Personal
relationships.
Yes. Yeah. Well, but you see.
But you see, in their cases, they would not even be bound by.
I understand that, but you know, I'm trying to say to you, if 90% of the purview is inapplicable or not applied, then there's a certain recalcitrance in a position that says, well, "Yeah, but those 10% that remain." Or that are applicable.
No, well, but don't forget. Let us say, if there is not a din Torah, nevertheless there is the concept of malchus dinah de malchus dinah, that the law of the commonwealth is the law. So we in Orthodoxy, as part of Orthodoxy, if somebody decides to go to the general courts for judgment, we expect him to abide by them. We expect him to live decently, and so forth. So these are all applicable in that respect.
I can't argue the point. I'm not trying to really. As far as Rabbi Freihoff is concerned, I guess.
In other words, what I'm trying to say is that somebody who washes his hands diligently before a meal, and refuses to give charity to the poor. Is not following the Shulchan Aruch, is not being consistent. I mean, both of them are part of the Shulchan Aruch. One of the rabbis, one from the Musa's school of rabbis, when something like that came of the fellow that was washing his hands diligently and refused to give charity, he says, you know, you pour all your Judaism down the drain.
Yeah, that's very good. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've never had any Musa in Pittsburgh, did we?
Musa's, not that I know of. I mean, not the Musa movement per se. Yeah. I don't know. I mean,
I don't know. Tell me a little about Halpern.
I didn't know Halpern. I mean, I knew him
well, but we
didn't get we didn't get together that often. Mm-hmm. That's all.
Mm-hmm.
When he was still in Oakland, where the Playhouse took over, I once gave a lecture on comparative religion there, and he was surprised to hear some of my statements from an Orthodox rabbi, because I had studied comparative religion quite a bit, especially when I was in Dropsy. So, Canaan, I'm not talking about comparative religion between Christianity and Judaism, but, for example, the Canaanite and Ugaritic things.
He was surprised you knew about it.
Not only that I knew, but I knew as much as I did.
Yeah, but so I don't know much about him. I'm trying to...
I'll tell you one thing about him is that he was sort of a hard-handed person when it came to running his... synagogue,
yes.
And everybody felt that once he left and he got an assistant, once he retired and he got an assistant to take over, which happened, that he would really be a thorn in the side of the new rabbi. And the truth of the matter is that he was one of the most gentlemanly of all. He refused to sit up on the pulpit. During services, he insisted on sitting amongst the congregation. He would not do anything in the synagogue unless it was a special request from the rabbi. So he was a real gentleman in that regard.
Thank you for that point. Mm-hmm. I would not have thought it.
He had a reputation of being pretty stern and wanting his own way and everything else. But he was a real gentleman when it came to his success. Which isn't true, I won't mention any names,
of everybody.
Of some of the others here in Pittsburgh who, during their rabbinate, or their active rabbinate, were very nice and very congenial.
Mm-hmm. And nevertheless required honors after retirement. Yes.
Right.
In that vein, let me ask about Temple Sinai. What was his name? The one who was there for a long time.
You mean Bob Ilson?
Ilson, yes. Uh-huh. Did you know him?
I knew him, but I mean, nothing special.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he also comes from an Orthodox background, I think he may have even gone to a yeshiva for a while.
Ilson?
Yeah.
That would surprise me.
Yeah.
I think he went to Hebrew Union College back around, I don't know, 20...
No, but he does come back. He does come from a... Now, his predecessor...
I didn't know him.
No, but he knew very little.
The predecessor?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't remember who was
I forgot his name. I can talk about him, but things that I suppose he wouldn't want repeated. Which happened after he left Pittsburgh. I think he had emotional problems.
Oh,
you know.
Forget that.
There's no sense in discussing that.
Speaking of emotional problems, Rabbi Rubenstein, did you know him?
Who's Rabbi Rubenstein?
He was a Hillel rabbi down in Pitt.
Oh, you mean the
Hillel rabbi?
I know him, but I didn't like what he did.
Did what?
Well, he was teaching, supposedly teaching Judaism to the kids, and he was turning them away from Judaism. He was. I know my brother who was in Erie at the time, and he's a conservative rabbi. He's now in the largest conservative synagogue in Philadelphia, Beth Shalom.
Your brother is at Beth Shalom in Philadelphia.
The one that Frank Lloyd Wright built.
Yes.
And he used to tell me that some of his kids from Erie would come down. They were pretty well orientated into Judaism. And they'd come down and get under Rubenstein's
influence,
and under his influence, and they'd come back denying everything.
Mm-hmm.
The practice, and I felt that this was a very unwholesome attitude. I have no objection to him wanting to believe whatever he wants to believe, but he had come here to teach
Judaism. That's right.
To college students.
That's
and
right.
Instead of teaching them Judaism, he was teaching them what was wrong with Judaism.
Yeah, that's what you thought. Did you ever hear him personally?
No, not really. But all I could tell is by what the kids came back. Whether he said these things or not, I have no way of knowing.
Mm-hmm.
Although in some of his books, he...
Did you ever read any book by him?
I read the excerpts. I never read the full book.
I would recommend that you would enjoy After Auschwitz.
Yeah.
I think it's a masterpiece myself.
No, After Auschwitz, I don't like this
whole... I'm not telling you whether you like it or not.
No,
or
but I
like it.
No, but I mean... But
the book.
But his concept, for example, in After Auschwitz, I read excerpts, as I say. That the Germans looked upon the Jews as a four-letter word that is not so nice, and that therefore the Germans would never have any relations, even with the most beautiful of Jewish women, because that was their concept of it. Well, that's factually wrong. They had brothels with the Jewish women. And we know from history that's wrong. And he bases an entire thesis on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The reason I'm poking on Rabbi Rubenstein, lots of people think of him as a very significant theologian.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't have a lot of two significant theologians, you know, as theologians, not rabbis and not Zionists and so on. And he has a lot more than just After Auschwitz. The book After Auschwitz has about 20 essays in them, ranging over a number of things, some of which could be interpreted easily the way you've spoken of them. But question is, what would be your reaction to a broader purview? But then why should you read it? Okay, pardon my...
No, that's a... Well, I, to tell you the truth, there may be a prejudice on my part.
I want you to express that.
Yeah. But I don't have too much respect for his point of view.
For people like that, okay.
No, I don't, for his point of view in general. Like, in fact, he came here,
uh-huh.
and that program I watched, he came here and he was on television
uh-huh.
with some television personality. She had been in prison in Canada, and she,
mm-hmm.
and then she became a personality here, an anchor woman. I forgot her name. But anyway, he had come into town, and she was into... pushing one of his books,
uh-huh.
and she was interviewing him, and he told her quite frankly, he said, the reason I joined the rabbinate is because I wanted power. And he said, I didn't have the money to get power. And that's what he said.
Yeah.
And he said, so I felt that as a rabbi, I could have power, and that's,
mm-hmm.
That's what I joined the rabbinate for.
Mm-hmm. I think there are all sorts of motives in people's lives. Was in some respects a nut, and meaning not balanced, is what I mean by that. On the other hand, some very unbalanced people have sometimes discerned great profundities, and I think he has. I was just wondering what your perception of him was, and you said that.
Yeah.
Any other person that you think we could recall on the Pittsburgh scene?
I don't know.
Wait a minute, Rabbi Pupko.
Yes,
he was
a classmate of mine.
Rabbi Pupko was a classmate of yours.
Yes, and we were roommates for a while.
Uh-huh.
He's a distant cousin of mine,
mm-hmm.
and we went to the yeshiva together. And we both, in fact, when we were studying Yeridaya, we studied Yeredeia together. That's
mm-hmm.
the code book. And we both got our exams for smicha ordination within the same day. You know,
yes.
we were taken in for a 5-hour interview by three of the leading rabbis of the yeshiva at the time. One of them was Rabbi Arnovich, who was the major rabbi.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
And the other rabbi was Rabbi Leventhal from Philadelphia,
mm-hmm.
and the third one, and he was the junior member of the group, was Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik,
mm-hmm.
And they were the three men who examined us, and we both got smich at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
He has a tremendous sense of humor. People may not realize
okay.
that. Oh, yes.
I think he's a terrific guy.
People do not realize that he used to, when he'd get up and perform at the yeshiva,
uh-huh.
He would put us in stitches. We would...
tell me one. Do you remember any?
Well, I mean, he would imitate Dr. Rebel, for example,
mm-hmm.
and so
mm-hmm.
forth, and do it to a T,
uh-huh.
and he was, but in general, he didn't tell stories, but he just had an innate sense of humor that
mm-hmm.
was remarkable.
Mimicry,
and
yeah.
in general, seeing the humorous side of it.
He's an actor.
Yeah, seeing the
mm-hmm.
Humorous side of things. He could keep you in stitches. We had a recent reunion, and he got up and he spoke, and he started telling story, and he had us laughing
yeah.
again.
Yeah, how come his Yiddish is so good, you know?
Well, don't forget, he came here when he was about 13 years old.
I didn't know that.
So
he
spoke Yiddish. Yiddish was his language.
It's his mama Russian.
That's right, and Russian, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Both
and
Russian.
Russian.
Yeah. So this was it. And in fact, his father put him into the yeshivas immediately, and therefore he was able to talk Yiddish. Now another fellow who came about the same time, at the same age that he did, Eugene Michali, he became a Reform rabbi. He's one of the mentors at Hebrew Union College. He teaches them all they know about Talmud. He was a bright fellow. He has no accent because his father, he was from one of the Baltimore group, and his father kept him in Baltimore. And he lost his accent,
mm-hmm.
whereas Pupko
kept it
because he was in a milieu where he was able to speak Yiddish quite often. But that's why he's proficient in Yiddish. But for that matter, for example, all the studies in Talmud were all in Yiddish.
Mm-hmm.
I came here when I was 2 years old, but until I went into school, public school, I was speaking Yiddish all the time.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, there was one kid who used to beat me up because he'd speak to me in English and I didn't understand him, and he beat me up because
mm-hmm.
he what the heck, he'd talk to me and I wouldn't
mm-hmm.
answer him. And for example, when I was here, when I first came here, I used to deliver, one Saturday I'd deliver an English sermon, the next Saturday a Yiddish sermon.
Yes, sir. Can you still do it as handily as you ever could?
I can still do it, but don't forget that I haven't been doing it for the last 20, 25 years.
Yes, but Puk or Kam?
Well, I suppose I can speak Yiddish, give a Yiddish sermon as well as Puk.
If somebody said, today we're going to talk congregation in Yiddish, you would have no trouble.
No, I'd have no problem. But nevertheless, you didn't have the fluency now that you did then.
Uh-huh.
In fact, my late mother, recently, before she passed away, I would use certain words, and she said, "Where'd you get that word? I haven't heard it since I left Europe."
Yeah. Yes.
But so he was, and of course he knew Talmud and stuff. I mean, that goes without saying. I mean, all of our
mm-hmm.
element, we knew Talmud.
That's right.
We knew the codes.
He seems to get along fairly well with the black coats.
Yeah, because he's in amongst them and so forth, whereas they're not in East Liberty.
Mm-hmm. You mean because of his physical proximity?
No, I would think so.
Except for he gave the talk the other day at Shalom at the memorial service.
Yes. The Yom HaShoah.
Yom HaShoah, right.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen him at community meetings, federation meetings. He has a little more patience and participation with the broader Jewish
mm-hmm.
segment than I would say the so-called black coats do.
Yeah.
And yet he is quite acceptable to them.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
And
I don't know. I mean, the black coats, I don't know if, unless you're a real black coat, you're not acceptable.
Is that
to
right?
Them. But let me say, they tolerate him more than they tolerate somebody else.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
That's about it.
That's an interesting point.
Yeah.
What more about him? What sort of person is he?
Well, he's a Zionist, which is something that the black coats and
some of them are not.
Yeah, quite a number of them are not. Mizrahi is there.
Yes,
he was he was national president of Mizrahi, so he's there. He did get his PhD from Pitt.
Mm-hmm.
So
in what?
Education, same as I did. Religious education, but the same as I did.
Mm-hmm.
And so he did get his PhD from Pitt. And he did go to Columbia for a while. I think he studied under Baron in
mm-hmm.
Columbia, maybe
mm-hmm.
for a year or so.
Mm-hmm.
And so you see, he does have that other facet to his.
He has a broader education.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It shows.
Yeah.
It really does show.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think he's very well respected.
Yes.
A lot of people
mm-hmm.
like him
yeah.
As a rabbi.
Mm-hmm.
I've had very little to do with him, of course. Just general observation.
Yeah.
He always struck me as a mensch.
Yeah.
That is,
he didn't hide himself.
Yeah.
Well, so I've known him for most of my, since I've been in college, which
mm-hmm.
is since I've been 17.
That's a long time.
Yes, yeah, so, and he's a good friend.
Yeah, good.
Yeah.
Good. I like. And I have one story about him that you're the one supposed to be telling them, but not me. It was a very brief one. He was somebody complained about the Kashrut at Hebrew Institute
mm-hmm.
some years back, and he said that he was responsible for the Mashgiach there,
yeah.
And was this person presuming to tell him
mm-hmm.
go how he's to do his job,
yeah.
And he dismissed the thing. And I don't know what state of kashrut is right now, but he was at that point responsible. He had a mashgiach there. But he would brook no nonsense from any complainant. And that ended the matter.
Yeah.
You tell me a story like that.
Well, I don't know of anything offhand, you know, that I can tell you about.
Mm-hmm.
If there was some context, maybe I could.
Yeah. How about, who are the people over at, the one on Phillips?
You mean Shapiro was here? Joe Shapiro was here when I was here.
Uh-huh.
And he was very well respected, not only in his congregation, but in the community at large.
Mm-hmm.
But he was also a fellow that didn't mix too much, you know. For example, when we organized the rabbinic fellowship, he did not join. Not only that, but when we organized the rabbinic board, which was the Orthodox rabbi, he was a member of the Vada Rabbonim, which was with the older men. But when the younger men, at that time older men, organized their own rabbinic board, he did not join.
Mm-hmm. What is there now that covers the whole Pittsburgh Rabbinate? What's it called?
The Rabbinic Fellowship.
Yeah, the Rabbinic Fellowship.
Yeah. Well, now, see, to give you an idea of the broad outlook of PUPCO, the fact is that when the Rabbinic Fellowship was organized, PUPCO and I were amongst the founders the Rabbinic Fellowship.
I remember when he was...
So the two of us were amongst the founders. I was the first Orthodox president that they had, but PUPCO and I were amongst the founders. And the black hats, to them, that would be practically sacrilegious.
Did the Rabbinic Fellowship include all?
All
Jewish
three facets.
Yes.
Including the Reformed.
Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And is there any capability to function there?
Oh, yeah, we function all the time.
Oh, about a year or two ago, I was part of a little group.
We have one proviso that on theological groups, each group has a veto power.
About 2 years ago or more, Jerry Rosenberg, still, you know Jerry?
Sure. From Pitt.
From Pitt, yes. And I was on a
committee. I married
kids. Yes, good. And I wanted...
Not personally, I appreciate it.
Yeah, I understood you the first time. We wanted the Rabbinic Fellowship to consider the issue of some sort of community get provision.
Well, that would be practically
based upon the Denver principle.
Yeah.
Why they
practically crucified the rabbi.
Well, why couldn't it be discussed?
Well, anyway, no, it wouldn't. It would be practically impossible because the same things that prevailed in Denver would have prevailed here. And my guess is also that the Denver Reform and Conservative group is not as doctrinaire as the ones here. The older ones were more conservative, and at least the conservative rabbis were more flexible. The younger ones are more gung-ho conservative, and there would be difficulty in getting a compromise with them, similar to what was done in Denver.
See, what happened in Denver need not, you know, you can make progress, and there are different contexts always. I thought that the problem here would be primarily from the Reform, and I don't see why it couldn't have been discussed.
I think that it would have been, an effort in futility.
Mm-hmm. Were you aware of this request?
I don't remember it.
Not more than 2 years ago. We sent something to the...
PUPCO may have been
PUPCO, who was it there at the time? But he said, I don't want... We asked whether we could send the communication down, and we were told no.
Unless it was statement.
It was a statement. A statement. Maybe it was PUPCO. But my point was that were disappointed that there couldn't be a discussion.
But basically, when we set it up, we said specifically that we would not deal with theological problems. That was one of the...
It's a Jewish
community.
Yeah, but nevertheless, all
necessity.
Yeah, all theological problems are. But this was one of the bases for the establishment of the fellowship. Otherwise, it would never have come.
I understood that. I still understand it. How can we go ahead and have Klal Yisrael if nobody wants to discuss Get?
Well, it's a problem, but it's a problem in Israel. It's a problem all over. It is a problem.
I guess you got any good in welfare?
What's that?
You have any good in welfare?
Unless there's anything specific you want to think.
I can't think much more. We're at the end of the tape.
Okay.
And maybe we'll come back, maybe not. You'd be kind enough. But right now, maybe the council will decide that they've heard enough from us.
Yeah, well, I presume so. He gets such a thing like overkill.
Thanks a lot.
Okay.